This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we meet with a member of the legal team for Julian Assange. The team has been having difficulty getting access to see their client, who remains in London's high-security Belmarsh prison. Rounding out our coverage of Julian Assange's case, we go bi-coastal with speeches from New York and Los Angeles.
First, we have attorney Barry Pollack, who's the attorney for Julian Assange in Washington, D.C., speaking at an early February meeting in Los Angeles. And then we have Glenn Ford speaking last week at CUNY Law School about the Julian Assange attack.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. We continue our ongoing coverage of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who remains in confinement at London's high-security Belmarsh prison. Julian is fighting extradition to the United States on 18 charges. They include violating the Espionage Act and conspiring to hack government computers. As listeners will recall, the charges are in connection with WikiLeaks' release of thousands of secret cables in 2010. Joining us with an update is Renata Avila, a member of Julian's legal team. Renata is an international human rights attorney from Guatemala, specializing in preserving human rights during the next wave of technology challenges. She's a board member for Creative Commons, the Common Action Forum, and is a global trustee of the think tank Digital Future Society. She's also a member of the WEF's Global Future Council on Human Rights and Technology, and a steering committee member of the Information Society Advisory Council for the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Renata, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me here. Actually, it's one very special place to be because it makes me remember Michael Ratner a lot, one of my mentors and my heroes.
He was our hero as well. Renata, tell us, why hasn't the legal team received much time to visit Julian during his confinement at Belmarsh Prison in London?
Purely arbitrariness of the judge. It could be more flexible. I mean, I want to start by one point. It is an injustice that he is in pretrial detention instead of, like, you know, house arrest. The argument of the court is that he jumped bail, but the counter argument is that he only jumped bail to exercise his right of asylum. So he never wanted to leave the UK. He has always been willing to face justice. He has never evaded the law. And imagine how different will it be for him to prepare for one of the most complicated cases in history, from house arrest, to recover his health, to spend time with his family. I mean, it is total injustice that he has to be under such conditions. So on top of that, the conditions that he's under at the moment are very harsh. Arguing, of course, if you... You have to understand something in the case of Julian, because it's a political persecution and the process is the punishment. If they can find excuses to make his life more difficult, the authorities will find excuses to make his life more difficult. It's a pure case of lawfare.
This reminds me, I think you know Jeremy Hammond, who's finishing his 10-year sentence, but he'll get out a little early. One of the problems in Jeremy's case, which was also violating the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, was that he didn't have enough time with his attorneys. And we know that Margaret and Sarah Kunstler were representing him. He didn't have enough time to go over the electronic evidence. And that's why these cases that involve computers are so difficult and unfair for the defendants.
Of course, of course. And in the case of Julian, I mean, which is different from the case of Hammond, he's an expert. And he needs to explain to his lawyers, who are not computer experts, very careful. There need to be an intense coordination between the lawyers and him. And it must be like a lot of suffering for him, knowing that he knows and he cannot convey, and he has not enough time to convey the information to his lawyers. So the process is very irregular. I want to call also the attention to another layer of complexity, and it is the complicity of Ecuador handing over all his personal belongings to the U.S. Justice Department. It was requested, it's very underreported, but it was requested when he exited the embassy, the Department of Justice requested to Ecuador to hand over all the things inside the embassy belonging to Julian. So imagine, it is like it is such invasive, such broad request.
Did that include computers?
Computers, telephones, personal books, notes, all the footage that the Ecuadorians had on illegal surveillance, all the things of an estate of 7 years. I mean, it was like his entire home was seized. And this is an absolute, a blatant abuse of process.
I read something you wrote, I think it was a tweet, where you referred to lawyers and supporters of Assange being monitored.
Yes, yes.
Can you
yes.
talk about that?
It is very interesting. And I want to, when I started working on this, I was used to surveillance because I was working in Guatemala in the genocide case, and personal experience, I will receive, it was very interesting, my invoice of the telephone company open and highlighted, because you have a record of all the phone calls, and they will highlight all my phone calls with Spain, because I was coordinating with a group of international lawyers in Spain to get the military extradited. So it was like that message, we are listening to you. So those were lawyers from Spain and me in constant contact. And at that time, at least, the surveillance was kind of visible, you know. But I was used to navigating that. I always assumed that these kind of cases, you have to face different level of difficulties. The problem in the case of Julian is that it was impossible. Like, it was, you are okay, like, I'm not okay with that. Of course, it's illegal, but you can prepare and you can protect and you can use techniques when it is certain level of surveillance. But in the case of Julian, it has been so intense, so invasive, and with the collaboration of the most powerful surveillance apparatus in the world, that it has been impossible to even have a private conversation with him. When he was under house arrest, I remember that we used to have long walks into the forest to discuss private conversations on his case. And I used to take notes, then I used to go home and burn the notes, because I couldn't even be sure that, you know, serious issues. When he entered the embassy, it became even more difficult, because we knew that the British were listening, and we know the capabilities of surveillance of the US. So we used to take extra measures. The extra measures were not effective because the government that we thought was on our side, Ecuador, was also exercising like intense surveillance all over the place. So you couldn't even go to the toilet.
How did you figure that out?
We only found when this UC Global company was, and now is part that we are like taking a case against this UC Global company. There was a security company hired by Ecuador, private security company hired by Ecuador to guard the embassy. It was not hired to guard the embassy. In reality, they were hired to spy on Julian. Cameras in the toilet.
How did you know there were cameras in the toilet?
Well, we discovered because there's footage of us in the toilet, because we thought that it was the impossible place to be bugged, ladies' toilet to be specific. We used to have with Julian the conversations inside the bathroom. You know, it was ridiculous. We were like three lawyers will have to squeeze in the bathroom. We will turn on the
faucet.
Yes. And we will whisper into his ear. So it was like super, like, how can you How can you work under such conditions? How can you instruct your lawyers under such conditions? How can you prepare a defense if you cannot even instruct your lawyers with enough freedom? And that's why I think that this really intense surveillance over 7 years makes the possibility of his defense, of a fair defense, like it is not going to happen. I mean,
did you find footage of yourselves?
In the proceedings, in the discovery proceedings, it was very, very, very useful because now we have the catalog of videos that were like submitted in the case by this company. It is incredible because we have videos on all the people who visited the embassy and all, and we discovered that they were even spying at that level. And for example, visits of Pamela Anderson, all the lawyers, all the doctors, his closer friends and family members, everybody is there.
This really,
journalists.
It shocks the conscience, especially monitoring lawyers.
Monitoring lawyers and monitoring medical doctors, because he couldn't go to the doctor, you know, he had to receive the doctors inside the embassy, and monitoring also his most intimate interactions with his family, you know, like it's unacceptable.
You referenced Julian's health a bit earlier. Can you give us an update on his health and mental state?
You know, that will be one of the most important issues at the discussions in the upcoming weeks, because it is sad, but it's also a note of hope. Because one of the grounds on refusal of extradition is when health conditions are not good. And so we submitted back in 2014 and 15 full report on his health situation to the UN when the UN was analyzing his arbitrary detention. And those documents are public, and then you can just update. You can just figure with an update how if it was that bad, because it was really, really bad, chronic depression, chronic conditions on his back, and so on. You can only imagine how it was, how bad it was 3 years after. So I do not have access, and those will be documents submitted to the court of the latest. But I can, journalist should take a look at the at two documents. One is the report of the UN, the UN decision on arbitrary detention. Is the decision number 15, 2015. And the second document is the report of Niels Melsner, the UN Special Rapporteur on Torture. Those are the two very recent reports by the UN, not by us, by the UN, where you can find objective information about his situation. And a third one is the opinion of Joseph Kanatachi. Joseph Kanatachi is the UN Special Rapporteur on Privacy. He also made an opinion on how this invasive situation was a violation of more than just privacy, other rights.
Julian must feel so betrayed.
I think that Julian is a very intelligent person, and Julian prepared us for that. I think that we are more outraged than him. He prepared us for that, you know. He was very careful. But the thing is that surveillance is like an infection, you know, and you can only protect and immunize yourself to a point. When it's so pervasive, when it's everywhere, when it's in each and every space and device that you have, I think that the case of Julian is a clear example on how we need to fight back, because when you are surveilled all the time, you cannot exercise basic rights.
Let's talk about Julian's indictment in a larger sense and what it means for the future of citizen journalism and also the possibilities for a truly free and open internet?
Well, that's a difficult question. The first one, I will say that we are living very, very bad times. I think that if we would have looked back 2010 at WikiLeaks as a model, we would be better off. And number one, WikiLeaks was the one challenging the funding of journalism model. By delivering excellent journalism, they were able to crowdfund all the funds. But of course, PayPal got in the way. That was a first alert, first sign on financial censorship that we are now seeing, that is not only financial censorship, but platform censorship. If your ideas are inconvenient for the platforms, and by platforms I refer to not only the payment platforms, but the social media platforms, you're kicked off. The second sign, it was no advertisement. If you see, if you are in China, if you are in Sweden, if you are in the US, you enter the same neutral platform, WikiLeaks, and no one is monitoring what you're reading, because the model of WikiLeaks was not one based on monetizing the behavior of readers. That's one thing that we no longer have. We lost our right to read in private. And we are constantly exploited and monetized by the platforms. And the third one I loved, I think that is the characteristic I love the most of WikiLeaks, is, you know, that all this fake news, verifying information, credibility, all this hysteria, I will say, that is like invading all the and threatening freedom of expression. Well, WikiLeaks provided the solution much earlier, and the solution is full documents, because you didn't need to even question the statements of WikiLeaks, because you will have immediately, with any news published, there was a full document backing it.
And of course, for that, Julian became threatening to the status quo.
Exactly, because now this thing of verifying information is just an excuse to reduce our space of freedom of speech. And no one is talking about that. No one is talking how WikiLeaks was a pioneer in solving the fake news problem. How do you solve the fake news problem? Publish the full docs.
Renata, why do you think more journalists have not come out in support of Julian?
You know, I think that the situation is changing rapidly, and I will like to correct that statement, because it is really getting broader. Lots of mainstream organizations and journalists are suddenly realizing how serious this is. I think that they finally put feelings aside and egos aside, and they realize how this case can damage journalism forever, because what it is being punished here is the right to publish, the right to investigate, and the right to protect a source. Those are the three issues being discussed. And that affects everybody. And the interesting thing is that the status of Julian as a journalist is not being disputed. What is being disputed is his methods. If you think of the times that we are at now, and probable war with Iran, climate crisis really unfolding in very nasty ways, global epidemics, it's not looking good, the world. Now is the time when we need the most courageous investigative journalism to deliver accurate information, and that's what is under threat.
Were you surprised of recent revelations that Glenn Greenwald, who, as everyone knows, released Edward Snowden's revelations, were you surprised he was also indicted?
I was not surprised at all, because I have an office. I had a foundation in Chile that has also an office in Brazil, and my staff in Brazil, they are Brazilians of African descent, and they are, like, you know, at the epicenter of harassment, state violence, and discrimination. And that's why we are, like, monitoring very closely whatever happens in Brazil. And they were, like, friends of Marielle Franco, who's this amazing activist who was killed to be silenced because she was blowing the whistle, basically. Not even blowing the whistle. She was openly describing and investigating police violence. She happened to be one of the closest friends of Glenn and David Miranda, too. And it is the same group of people fighting for a more democratic and less racist Brazil, those who are under threat. Bolsonaro only replicates the bad practices of the U.S. from denying climate change to trying to reduce reproductive rights, from threatening scholars and independent journalists to trying to push a conservative agenda in all across the government. So I wasn't surprised, but I was just cautious on, I think that what we need to learn from the situation of Glenn Greenwald is that this will be copied in a much worse way elsewhere. And if you think that our attitude to protect and defend journalists, we had two journalists killed in the EU recently, you know. We had one journalist chopped into pieces inside an embassy. And I didn't see any Western country cutting ties with the Saudi regime because of that.
It's a perilous time for journalists. I did read statistics about the physical attacks, not just verbal, but as you alluded to, physical and even deaths globally are on the rise. As someone who advocates for information freedom, can you talk briefly, because we're coming to the end of our time together, about the consolidation of big tech? We have the so-called Big Five. You alluded earlier to social media reinforcing some of the problems that journalists have online. Do you think, or I should say, what impact has the Trump administration had on the consolidation of power in a few large tech companies?
You know, it was pretty much, I think that Obama played a greater role on that. When Trump arrived, everything was already like too late to act upon. And I don't think that he has really an active role on that. I mean, he's just being very permissive and not taking any action about it. Because it's good for business, you know, it's good for America, he will claim. I think that the consolidation happened much earlier and was during the Obama administration, to be honest. With the Obama arrival, he was like so happy with this sector that it became really, really, really mess in the sense like mixed. You will see more and more the Pentagon getting involved with the companies and Washington getting more like aggressive in defending the interest of these companies, sacrificing the interest of citizens while doing so. And it is interesting because now this weird diplomacy, you know, it was a form of diplomacy, how the government will play by sending these tech entrepreneurs like Mark Zuckerberg as envoys to China. I saw many pictures of Eric Schmidt or Mark Zuckerberg taken while they were visiting heads of state. So they became sort of diplomats of this new consolidation of tech power with military power, with diplomatic power.
Let's get back to Julian's case for as we wind up. I understand that Westminster Magistrates Court in London has essentially ruled to bifurcate the month-long extradition hearing. So there will be a week-long session to begin on February 24th. As it stands now, the second part will be pushed back to late May or early June. Why has this taken so long?
Actually, it's quite regular time. What we need to consider is the complexity of the case. And I am glad that it was requested and not an intense process of three nonstop weeks. Because what will happen now is on the 24th, the U.S. Justice Department will deliver the arguments that they have against Julian, and they will submit the list of evidence. The second day, the defense will reply and say, like, why this is outrageous and is a crime against journalism. Then the following days, it is about jurisdiction, and the applicable law. So the discussion will be around whether or not a political offense is extraditable and whether or not the treaty between the U.S. and the U.K. is valid for this situation. And it's just the submission of the arguments, not the discussion of the arguments. And the last day of the week will decide on the proceeding, what comes next. So we will know by Friday the schedule of the next batch of hearings, which will include experts, witnesses, and so on. This is not the trial. I mean, it's important. This is not the trial. For those listening, it's important to understand that this is a long and torturous journey for Julian. This, imagine 4 weeks of hearings only to decide whether he's extraditable or not. We are at the very beginning of this case, because if he is extradited, a long process will follow here as well, because the substance of the case is not debated in an extradition hearing, just whether it is a political offense and whether there are conditions authorizing his extradition. That's important. But also, that's where all our efforts should be focused, because we don't want this case to arrive in the U.S. We don't want this case to arrive in the U.S. when the judiciary is so compromised. We don't want this case to arrive in a situation of high polarization when you need independent journalism the most. If I was an American, even if I disliked WikiLeaks, I will be like rioting in the streets, you know, for this case not to come here. If this case comes here, and if this case is discussed under the current political circumstances, it will be kryptonite for journalists. It will be like very dangerous. So my message will be like, let's keep it away, you know. It's like the coronavirus of journalism, you know. Like, if we get this case open here, given the current composition of courts and of the Supreme Court, you will have dark times ahead.
So well put. It will really be, I think, a death knell for journalism in this country. Now, just in our remaining minutes, if Julian is not extradited, what happens to him?
Diplomatic game starts, and the absent actor there is the government of Australia. He's an Australian journalist, and the diplomats in Australia are just doing the minimum, you know, the minimum basic things. They're not advocating for the freedom of one of their citizens, and they have done it in the past. I mean, one of the lawyers in charge of the defense of Julian in the past, Melinda Taylor, she was detained in Libya, and they moved earth and heavens to get her out.
And listeners should know, excuse me for interrupting you, that Australia is part of the so-called Five Eyes.
Precisely.
That collaborate. That's New Zealand, UK, Canada, Australia, and the United States.
And it looks pathetic, you know. It looks pathetic. It looks like they should become yet another star in the flag of the US, because they are acting like banana republic. They are acting like total colony. And it's a shame. I mean, some political movements are starting there in support of Julian, but at the highest level, it is embarrassing, their inaction. So part of the things that we can do is to make that visible and unacceptable.
How can our listeners help Julian?
Well, first, by fighting the smears. I think that one of the most important things is to not believe once you read something nasty on a newspaper about him, his personality, his behavior, his intentions, ask yourself, does the journalist writing this column ever met Julian? In most of the cases, they have never met him, you know. I have shared a lot of time with him during the last 10 years, and I can tell you that he's a really nice person. He's a really nice, talented person, who, unlike Mark Zuckerberg and others, he dedicated his gift of technology and put it at the service of the public interest. He's not rich. You know, he could have been, like, in Silicon Valley, earning a lot of money and living a very peaceful, comfortable life and letting all his knowledge of what's going on in the world and with our freedom pass. Because it was not affecting him, you know. And he's doing that for us, you know, for all of us, but especially for those of us who are like concerned about social justice, concerned about activism, and trying to change the world for better. So we need to be grateful about it, and we need to be appreciative of his courage.
So important that you reminded us about that, Renata. How can listeners follow you?
Well, I think that I will try. I will do my best to try to write more, not only tweets. You know, like social media can be a trap.
Yes.
And I will try. We will put a group of us. We will try to put good summaries on the information, and at least to share with media good links on the summaries of what will be going on in the upcoming weeks. That will be our contribution. I cannot promise that it will be like delivered daily, but we will do our best to have at least to share the resources that are the most accurate for people willing to follow in detail the case of Julian.
What is your handle on social media, and I guess which platforms?
I only use Twitter.
Twitter, okay.
Avila Renata.
We'll put that on our website.
Great.
Renata, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. We hope when Julian's extradition request fails, we'll be able to have you back on to celebrate.
Oh, I will be back. I will be back, and we will be celebrating and preparing for the next fight.
Yes. Thank you so much for your really important work.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
We go now to hear Julian Assange's attorney Barry Pollack speaking at a UCLA event on February 9th.
Thank you. As we've learned here today, it was back in 2013 that Chelsea Manning was convicted of leaking the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, the State Department cables to WikiLeaks, who published those back in 2010 and 2011. As was just mentioned, in 2013, the Obama administration, after Manning was convicted, it was widely reported, decided that they would not charge Julian Assange, even though they had charged and convicted the leaker, because you could not in any principled way charge a publisher for publishing truthful information. The Obama administration referred to what it called the New York Times problem. If we were to charge Julian Assange for publishing this information, how could we not charge the New York Times for what it does every day of the week? In December of 2017, the Trump administration's Department of Justice secretly charged Julian Assange criminally. And of course, in April of this past year, 2019, he was expelled from the embassy, and the United States sought extradition on that charge that had been pending secretly since December of 2017. He was charged with conspiracy to violate the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. If you read the Department of Justice's press release, the press release said, WikiLeaks founder charged in computer hacking conspiracy. Well, that's how they solved the New York Times problem. We're not going to charge him for publishing, we're going to charge him for computer hacking. The only problem is, if you read the charging document, the word hacking doesn't appear anywhere in it. When Julian said, if I'm a journalist and I write a story, if I provide you the source documents, you can tell for yourself whether or not I'm telling you the truth. He was onto something. In fact, what the allegation in the indictment is that Chelsea Manning at some point asked someone who the government alleges was Assange, but somewhat affiliated with WikiLeaks, for help in trying to figure out if she could log onto her computer, not under her own name, but under the administrator's name, so it wouldn't be obvious that she was the one who was leaking this material. Computer hacking, at least to me, is gaining access through a computer to something that you don't otherwise have access to. Manning had access to all of this material, had leaked hundreds of thousands of documents using her own name, wanted to continue to leak documents, but didn't want to leave fingerprints on it if you believe the indictment. Also, if you believe the indictment, Assange came back and said, no luck, I'm not able to help you. And then Manning continued to leak under her own name. In other words, there's not a single document that was leaked or published as a result of this so-called hacking attempt. A month or so after Mr. Assange was expelled from the embassy, the United States brought a superseding indictment, charging not only the conspiracy to commit computer fraud and abuse, but charging 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act. At this point, the fig leaf that this was not a prosecution about the publication of truthful information had come off. 17 counts of violating the Espionage Act. He can get 5 years for the computer fraud and abuse violation. He can get 170 years, 10 years each, on the Espionage Act charges, a total of 175 years. The government makes one other effort, I think, to try to at least disguise the New York Times problem. What they've said publicly about the Espionage Act charges is, well, we're not charging him for publishing the collateral murder video. We're charging him because he's not a journalist. What he did was he published en masse the raw data, the raw files that included the names of sources that had helped the United States putting these people at risk. And of course, no responsible journalist would ever do that. Well, again, there are a couple of problems with the government's spin. First of all, Assange had all of this material, WikiLeaks had all of this material from Manning. It could have published all of it en masse at any time and scooped the whole world. It didn't. What it did is it gave this information to the New York Times, to The Guardian, and to Der Spiegel, so that these journalistic entities could go through the material and try to redact items that would cause undue harm. While it was in the possession of The Guardian, the password, these encrypted files, became known, and a number of sources got a hold of the raw material and put the raw material online. It was only after the material was online already that WikiLeaks made the decision, well, if it's already been published, we can put it on the WikiLeaks site. So factually, there's a problem there, but I think there's a bigger problem than that. The idea that the United States government should say, we don't agree with the editorial judgments that you made about what to publish, so therefore we're going to charge you with violating the Espionage Act, runs counter to the entire history of the First Amendment. We have always believed that it is up to publishers and journalists to make the decision as to what to publish, not to the government. And I think we should all be frightened by the prospect that the United States government is going to act as the editor-in-chief for every publication, yeah, not just in the United States, but for every publication around the globe. Thank you.
That was attorney Barry Pollack speaking at UCLA on February 9th about Julian Assange.
The New York Committee, formed to defend Julian Assange, had an event on February 15th at CUNY Law School, where we heard Glenn Ford, the editor of Black Agenda Report, give a speech in defense of Julian Assange. Give a listen.
Power to the people. My voice is kind of ailing, but I hope you'll bear with me. We all, of course, demand freedom for all of the political prisoners of empire, and that, of course, includes Julian Assange and Chelsea Manning. And we also demand that the exiles who have been targeted by U.S. empire be allowed to come home. And that list includes Edward Snowden, who's in exile in Russia, and Assata Shakur, who has long found refuge in Cuba. U.S. imperialism is unprecedented in world history in claiming the power, the right to police the world and to imprison and kill anyone that opposes its global supremacy. Its imperial mission is to erase everyone else's national sovereignty, everyone else's but its own, and to criminalize and demonize all resistance. It is an imperialism that subverts and ultimately erases the rule of law and subverts, substitutes its own vast powers of brute force for the rule of law. U.S. imperialism is barbarism. It is a worldwide disorder. It creates worldwide disorder purposely. It is an empire whose chief executive draws up assassination lists on Tuesday. That's what Obama did. Donald Trump is probably too disorganized to adhere to the Tuesday schedule, but all that means is that somebody else, some underling, is drawing up the kill list for him. When I was a young man, half a century ago, the Black Panther Party was at the top of the empire's kill list. In 1969, when the FBI and the Chicago police assassinated Fred Hampton and Mark Clark and many other members of the party, the CIA was busy assassinating tens of thousands of Vietnamese village leaders under the Phoenix program. The U.S. empire assassinates whole governments, whether they're popularly elected or not, from Iran to Guatemala to Chile to Congo to Libya to the attempted assassination of the lawful governments of Syria and Venezuela that is ongoing today. The U.S. has implanted more than 800 military bases around the world as a kind of global military occupation, a kind of army of occupation everywhere on the planet. And it has transformed the militaries of much of Africa into extensions of the U.S. military. It has transformed them into enemies of their own people. The United States meddles in the internal affairs of every nation on earth, and it spies on everybody who has a phone. It claims the singular, exceptional right to do so. Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, the organization that he founded, were put at the top of the empire's hit list. Assange became the empire's public enemy number one. Julian Assange is, of course, not a U.S. citizen. He's an Australian. But none of that matters because the United States asserts its own global rights and privileges over and above all others. It has universal jurisdiction in its own mind, and it backs it up with the tools of empire. Assange is therefore a traitor to empire and must be destroyed. The empire does not distinguish between internal and external threats because it considers the whole world as its imperial jurisdiction. And WikiLeaks was disrupting imperial rule. Americans are familiar with Chelsea Manning's release to WikiLeaks of that video and that audio of the U.S. helicopter troops and their massacre of Iraqi men, women, and children, and journalists and medical workers in Baghdad. Those images demolished the image of U.S. troops as liberators, and instead showing them behaving no differently than Nazi armies in Europe during World War II. Now, that, of course, was no secret to the Iraqis. The helicopter massacre was carried out in the bright light of day in Baghdad, and it was not that different than other, many, many other atrocities in Iraq. The Iraqis were no stranger to U.S. atrocities, but for U.S. audiences, these images were devastating. They utterly demolished the advertised picture of the U.S. military as a force for good in the world. It is images like these that turned the U.S. public against the war and made it impossible for the U.S. to again deploy its huge land army in the Middle East. That became politically impossible. That is why President Obama was compelled to arm and finance vast armies of Islamic jihadists, al-Qaeda, in fact, as ground troops of empire in Libya and in Syria. That is just one of the reasons that the U.S. empire will never forgive WikiLeaks, will never forgive Julian Assange, and will never forgive Chelsea Manning. They have contributed mightily to the weakening, the material weakening of U.S. imperialism's global war machine by making it partially unusable, by forcing the U.S. to openly ally itself with al-Qaeda, an alliance that the whole world knows about, except for the U.S. public. WikiLeaks and others have totally discredited the U.S. imperial project. WikiLeaks became such a threat to U.S. empire that the CIA and the rest of the U.S. imperial security apparatus treated it as a hostile foreign power. Now, we know that WikiLeaks is not a state power. It's just an organization. So the U.S. had to claim that WikiLeaks is an agent or an ally of an actual foreign power, that being Russia. It is from this that Russiagate was born. It is because of the massive disruption that WikiLeaks wrought on U.S. empire that publications like Black Agenda Report have been blacklisted and called dupes and agents of Russia. That's why Google has rigged its own algorithms, those wonders of science, to do exactly the opposite of what they are supposed to do, and to point people in exactly the opposite direction from which they are searching. WikiLeaks has done a great deal to tear the narrative of American exceptionalism to shreds. That's why Julian Assange is a political prisoner in Belmarsh. That's why he is among our most honored heroes of the real resistance, because the real resistance is the resistance to U.S. imperialism. Power to the people.
That was Glenn Ford speaking at CUNY Law School on February 15th.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP, 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF FM, 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio Green and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The Eye, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI, 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS, 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KABU, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM, Hood River. WSCA, 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD, 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ, 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI, 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW, 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT, 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG, 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL, 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP, 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD, 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP, 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRN-LP, 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC, 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR-LP, 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising Online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington, and KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODX LP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.